Eddie.
May it please the court. My name is William Mattingly, and I represent Westmoreland Coal Company. It dawned on me on Monday as I drove down here in the fog, and as I walked this morning when it was so beautiful and clear, that's exactly what I'm hoping this court will help us do. Because the parties in the Department of Labor are lost in a fog as to what modification means, and how do we handle that in black lung cases where a minor has passed away and the survivor files a survivor's claim. This court previously remanded this matter back to the administrative law judge, explaining that there were several factors that he should analyze in addition to determining if it did justice under the Act to consider the modification request that was filed by Westmoreland after the widow had filed her claim for benefits. The administrative law judge received the case back from the court in the summer of 07. That following January, he held a hearing. Lasted about 2 hours. The parties discussed all sorts of issues with him, concerns. He then issued a decision and order in March of 2008. Judge Kaplan addressed the court's concerns concerning diligence, motive, futility, and also addressed the concerns that modification doesn't automatically happen just because a party asks for it, but it has to render justice under the Act. He thoughtfully looked at the different factors, considered them, issued a decision and order, concluded that this was a proper case for modification, and that when he looked at the facts of the case, not only had the prior administrative law judge made a mistake in determination of fact, but the new evidence convinced him that there was not evidence of complicated co-worker's pneumoconiosis, so as to entitle the minor to benefits in his lifetime claim, and there was not automatic entitlement to benefits for the survivor's claim. The case went to the Benefits Review Board at the claimant's request. Certainly, claimants agreed with the denial of cases. The Benefits Review Board splits. An en banc panel of the Benefits Review Board splits.
They didn't consider the merits, though. It was the denial of rehearing. Isn't that correct on the en banc issue?
Yes. The en banc case was simply the denial.
A three-judge panel. Disagreed, as you pointed out, and then there was a petition for rehearing in banc.
Correct.
Bank, some of us call it, and that was denied 3-2.
It was. So it's about as split as you can get getting back to this court, and that's why I'm really here asking for guidance, and I think that's what all the parties in this case want. What do we do with modification cases? How broad is the standard? What happens in a case like this? When you look at what the Benefits Review Board did, they did not apply the correct standard of review. As this court explained, the standard of review is abuse of discretion. Really tough standard. Whether or not the administrative law judge clearly had a conclusion that was wrong. And what I believe that the Benefits Review Board did, and this is wrong, is that they chose to reweigh the factors and come to their own conclusions as to diligence, motive, futility, and whether, in their opinion, it would serve the interest of justice to allow the employer to reopen the case on modification. The board can't do that. The board has to look at the ALJ's considerations and adopt the ALJ's finding unless it is clearly wrong or an abuse of discretion by the administrative law judge. In essence, Judge King, you wrote the prior decision. I think what the Benefits Review Board did, what you and Judge Traxler wouldn't do on the prior occasion. And that is, you wouldn't substitute yourselves for the administrative law judge to judge these various factors. And that's what the board did, and that's incorrect. The board has overstepped the standard of review. They've not applied a correct abuse of discretion standard of review. So, the Benefits Review Board concludes that in looking at these motives, Westmoreland's motive was clearly to circumvent the law. The board can't be more wrong. As the director advocated and as the Seventh Circuit explained in the old Ben versus Hilliard case, there are two factors. One, accuracy trumps finality. Well, that's what the Department of Labor said to the Seventh Circuit. I'll be interested to see if they say that again today to this circuit, but that's what old Ben recorded as the Department of Labor's position. The other important position that the Department of Labor advocated there was a party should not be punished because it employs a procedural mechanism instituted by Congress. And that's all Westmoreland has done here. The widow filed her claim following her husband's death. In looking at the fact there was going to be discovery and that there was a finding of complicated pneumoconiosis, it was clear even before the Pond Creek decision that she would be entitled to benefits if complicated pneumoconiosis indeed was present. Based on that, it was requested that the district director relook at the case. And that's all modification is. You don't have to have a smoking gun. You don't have to have startling new evidence. You can ask that they look at the case, different than an appellate review where you have to show that substantial evidence doesn't support the ALJ's ultimate decision. So here it was asked that they relook at the case, and then several months later after discovery...
That's a request to the director.
That's correct. And that follows through to the ALJ.
The director possesses what, discretion on whether to do that or not?
The director possesses that discretion, whether or not it's in the interest of justice, according to the Supreme Court in the Banks and the O'Keefe versus Aerojet decisions. But that discretion then passes to the administrative law judge to determine if they should reopen the case and relook at it. In Old Ben, the Seventh Circuit sent it back for the administrative law judge to look at it. Now, there have been a couple cases that have been cited where the courts have ruled, no, a party cannot ask for reconsideration or modification of a prior decision. McCord versus Cephas is probably the best example. That's a case where an employer did nothing for 4 years, allowed a decision to be issued, and then attempted to use modification to set it aside. An abuse of the process, not in the interest of justice, clearly not what has happened here.
Well, here it was 7 years.
Here it was 7 years.
But you said but 4 years in that other case.
It's not the four years. It's what they did in that 4 years, Judge King.
All right.
They did nothing. They ignored orders. They ignored a subpoena. They didn't go to a hearing. And then after they got the final award, they said, oops, we want to modify that because it's within 1 year. Here what happened is the case went through litigation. An appeal was taken to the Benefits Review Board. No further review
was sought. You're back in 94 now.
I am. No further review is sought before the Fourth Circuit. It's only when the widow files her claim that it was thought, well, let's move for modification because the regulations do allow within 1 year of the last payment of benefits for any party to ask that the award be reconsidered, set aside, or terminated. And here, the new evidence showed that indeed there was a very good reason to set aside that prior claim and that prior decision because the finding of complicated pneumoconiosis was inconsistent with the subsequent treatment records and was inconsistent with the re-readings of the x-rays that were taken in the 1990s. The first administrative law judge had also made a couple errors in his weighing of the evidence. One, he credited certain physicians because he thought, well, you wouldn't want to disagree with your colleagues in the same group, but have failed to apply that standard equally because he credited physicians from the same group and didn't apply that reasoning for both different groups. The other thing he failed to realize is one physician had read an x-ray as complicated pneumoconiosis, and several months later in a treatment record, read another x-ray as not showing complicated pneumoconiosis. There's a few things we know about this disease. One of them is it doesn't go away. So it couldn't be complicated pneumoconiosis. As the treatment record showed and as these later x-rays showed, there were all sorts of medical reasons to find this was some type of infectious process, be it histoplasmosis or granulomatous disease or maybe even tuberculosis, but it wasn't complicated co-workers' pneumoconiosis. The Benefits Review Board has simply failed to appreciate that it's the ALJ's responsibility and privilege to look at all these factors. Now, probably what was most concerning to me was the point raised as, was there a proper party against whom modification of the minor's claim could proceed against? And I think there is.
What's that party?
That party was represented by Mrs. Sharp. Now, she wasn't formally appointed as responsible as the executrix or administratrix of the estate, but she took service and appeared before the administrative law judge, and very much invoked this court's jurisdiction, saying that she was a proper party to use this court's jurisdiction in the first case. She
say in your brief that by her actions in that regard, she waived the right to claim futility?
Yes. She waived that right.
By showing up in the administrative proceeding.
And presenting herself as a proper party to proceed on behalf of her deceased husband.
But there was never an estate.
There was never an estate, something now, we didn't find out until 2008.
When he passed away, I know he was in the coal mines in Virginia and West Virginia, both. Was he a West Virginian or Virginian, or do you know?
He ended up in Virginia. He started in West Virginia outside of Wheeling. Mm-hmm. And that's why this court has jurisdiction, even though he had moved to Pennsylvania. The right. Longshore Act traces back to the place of last employment where the injury occurred.
He was in Pennsylvania when he died.
Yes.
So the estate would have been in Pennsylvania.
Yes.
If it had been one.
But it would have
could
been.
Could a non-family member or somebody, could the coal company go in and?
I don't know that the coal company could have done anything
got an
in this case.
Administrator appointed or something?
Because there wasn't any outstanding judgment.
She was never there in any official capacity. In your hearing, she was never there in official capacity because there was no estate, so she was not there as an administratrix of her husband's estate.
She didn't, but she represented to the administrative law judge and then to this court that she had the authority to proceed on that behalf. And
well, she had her survivor's claim pending.
Yes, also.
Which you all were, that's the reason you brought this thing. You understand? I mean, you don't contest that, do you?
The survivors.
You don't. You initiated the modification proceeding in an effort to defeat her survivor's claim.
Yes, the survivor's claim opened that door, and had she waited 13 months to file the claim,
if this was going to defeat her survivor's claim, she had a pretty good reason to show up at the hearing.
She did, but she was.
But you're saying she was there representing her husband's.
In both capacities.
Her husband's estate. I guess you're saying he was there. That didn't exist.
She was relying on that prior order.
Yeah.
That awarded benefits to claim either collateral estoppel or that, look, complicated was found in the first case, so I automatically get benefits, even though everyone agrees he didn't die due to black lung. He died to a rupture abdominal aneurysm during a surgical procedure. The problem is the Department of Labor represented through the district director, and while we're at the administrative law judges, we had the proper parties. Mrs. Sharp represented through her attorney that she could proceed on behalf of her husband's estate. And in fact, Westmoreland relied upon all that.
But there was no estate.
There was none, because he had a will, but all the assets were held as joint tenants, so it passed through. I see my time has expired. I've saved some time.
You've got some time reserved. Ms. Rapolo?
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Rita Rapolo, and I represent the director of the Office of Workers' Compensation Programs. The board in this case properly determined that litigating and involving the issue of modification in the minor's claim was a futile effort. Yes, if there was an award in the minor's claim, and if through modification, it became a denial, then there would have been an overpayment to the minor, and the employer would have been able to seek that overpayment. But the overpayment must come from the minor or from his estate. The minor, in this case, at that point was dead, and there was no estate. So there's nothing that the employer in this case can gain on the minor's claim that would justify looking in to the request for modification. Employers' counsel suggests that the board improperly did what the ALJ was supposed to do to find out if modification was proper. The board did not do that. The board took the facts that the ALJ determined, that there was no money out there for repayment, that the employer had no financial incentive to be proceeding. And because of that, the board took that fact and looked to the legal implication of that, which was the employer is simply asking for modification when it, in the end, would be a futile effort. That is what...
Why is it futile? I thought that the appellant indicated, at least in their brief, and I thought that's what the ALJ determined, was that if it were determined that the award was erroneous, then that would defeat the appellee plaintiff's claim for survivor benefits.
Yes, there is no doubt that the award in the minor's claim will have a legal impact on the survivor's claim, but there is nothing in the modification provision that allows a fact finder, when determining what that fact finder can do a modification, there's nothing that allows that fact finder to look at things beyond the minor's claim. If you look at the modification provision and what it does, it talks about the fact finder can terminate, continue, increase, decrease compensation. It doesn't say anything at all about considering whether a finding or a decision in the minor's claim is going to have some effect on a separate, distinct survivor's claim.
Well, certainly there's a logical connection there.
Excuse me?
I said certainly there's a logical connection between the two.
There is a connection, but the modification provision is without doubt extremely broad and very unusual to have that sort of broad reopening provision. And what cannot be done is to make it even broader by saying not only can you modify a minor's claim and look to the reasons for yes or no to modify, but you can also look to whether that the award in the minor's claim will have some impact in some separate, distinct claim.
If the Fourth Circuit's already said you could do that in this Pond Creek case, if it goes the other way, why wouldn't it go this way as well?
Because when there is the decision, the proper decision in the minor's claim, and that decision is a valid decision, and there is no way because of futility to modify it, then it is a valid decision and it must be considered in the survivor's claim. If the employer had any problem with the finding in the minor's claim, at any time during that 6+ years, could have modified then when the employer was still giving benefits to the minor, when the minor was still alive. They waited almost 7 years. And now the ALJ in this case thought that wasn't a big deal because he said, well, you know, the claimant, the minor, was getting paid all these 7 years. What's the harm? Well, each case is different, but there was harm in this case. First, you have the minor and Mrs. Sharp, who got lulled into thinking that it was understood that the minor had complicated pneumoconiosis. But even more to the point, if you look closely at the record, you'll see that there was evidence, there was x-rays that were around during the minor's claim, but some of those x-rays survived, but some of them did not, because the hospital that had those x-rays, they destroyed them after a certain amount of years. In fact, the x-ray that was read as positive for complicated pneumoconiosis by most of the doctors that read complicated, that x-ray was destroyed. So there was prejudice. And in this case, yes, the ALJ did look at the different criteria that this court suggested, but he didn't do it thoroughly. He didn't look at the prejudice to the minor and Mrs. Sharp. And I think also he continued to do what this court said not to do, and talk encouraged to act based on the issue of was the original decision in the minor's case right or wrong? Because he says, no, how can I possibly, you know, not modify the minor's claim? Because if it's wrong, then this widow is going to be getting benefits when she shouldn't be getting benefits. That's, again, it's looking to the accuracy of the original decision. And that is very important. But this court said there were other things to consider. And I think, just wanted to say one more point about the issue of motive. The ALJ said that, well, it was a reasonable motive on the part of the employer to try to get the decision in the Myers case changed, because that's going to have preclusive effect. Well, yes, that's not an unacceptable motive, but it has to be done in the confines of how modification is done. And it's not done in a situation where in the minor's claim, it would lead, a modification in the minor's claim would lead to a futile determination. Not to mention that it's the ALJ's weighing of the mistake and finding a mistake in finding an award in the minor's claim is questionable. I think if you look at his decision, it's not clear that he understood when a moving party seeks modification, as the employer did in this case, the employer has the burden of proof to show that there was, in fact, a mistake. It's not clear that the ALJ was aware of this. The ALJ also didn't mention that in the minor's claim, the employer had stipulated that the minor had simple pneumoconiosis. Now that, of course, is different than the issue of whether the minor has complicated the more serious one. But given that the party stipulated to simple pneumoconiosis, that should have been something considered when the ALJ read and weighed the list of x-ray evidence, whether it was complicated or simple or nothing at all. And there were a number of doctors who found no complicated pneumoconiosis on x-ray. But interestingly, they also found no simple pneumoconiosis at all. And in that type of situation, a fact finder is encouraged to say, well, what credit should I give this doctor on complicated when he got it wrong on simple? And so when a fact finder is weighing those x-rays, he or she should be aware of whether a doctor who says there's no complicated pneumoconiosis really has an accurate picture of what is going on with this minor. If there are no more questions, I thank you.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Bednarz.
May it please the court, my name is John Bednarz. I represent May Ann Sharp. I haven't heard anyone mention the interests of justice. We have been back and forth on this matter now for 12 years.
Mr. Mattingly mentioned it.
Well,
I believe he did, and cited the Supreme Court case that
I would
made
submit
it the law of this case.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
I'm sorry, you go ahead.
I'm very sorry. Going back to the estate issue, the employer had the opportunity right from the start to request, by way of interrogatories or request for production of documents, the evidence from May Sharp that would have put them on notice right from the start that there was no estate, there was no opportunity for an estate to be raised. And in Pennsylvania, if a claim is going to be made against an estate, a third party can actually open an estate. It's permissible. So If they had explored that opportunity, if they had done their due diligence, they would have found right from the start. So I would submit to you on the futility argument, at least as it goes to being able to collect any of the miners' benefits, that's unequivocal. But let's talk about the actual evidence that Judge Kaplan looked at. Mr. Sharp had been dead in 2008 at the time of the January hearing for 8 years at that point. It's clear that there was no biopsy evidence, no autopsy evidence, and all that the judge did, essentially, was take the x-rays, many of which were done in extremis at the time that Mr. Sharp was on his deathbed, and I'm still not sure that he did anything more than count heads. The issue of motive here, I think, goes to why didn't Westmoreland, during the time from when they let the 1994 decision become final, why didn't they explore? They were paying bills, or they were paying the Department of Labor to pay bills. So they knew that this claimant, Mr. Sharp, was treating. They could have, and had the opportunity, and I'm sure in the past, have explored what evidence was out there from 1994 up to the time of his death. At that point, they had plenty of time. They had 6 years from that point. Another issue that seriously concerns me is as to getting this court's final answer on what modification really allows. The real problem here is that we relied upon the irrebuttable presumption, and we were not given the opportunity to submit the death certificate, which showed that the minor's death did have a relationship. And that was done very early on, and actually it was brought up in my first brief before this court. We were not given the opportunity, despite the fact that Mr. Mattingly had the opportunity granted by my agreement to take Dr. Fino's deposition outside of the 20-day rule. But I would submit to you that you consider that Judge Kaplan abused.
You didn't introduce the death certificate at the ALJ's hearing, that's the decision of which is now before us?
I did not. I was not given the opportunity to submit an amended death certificate, Your Honor, which we had and submitted in a motion for rebuttal, which Judge Kaplan ruled was out of time. I submit to you that because of the whole process of a modification, that...
So it wasn't denied on the merits. It was denied because you were late.
At the hearing, he gave me an...
Did you assign error to that finding?
I did.
And did the board agree with you?
Yes. I believe they did.
That the ALJ's decision should be reversed because you weren't allowed to file an amended death certificate?
I don't think that they went that far, Your Honor. But I think if justice is to be served, then the rules here should be allowed to go both ways. I mean, it's one of those situations where it was not that significant a period of time, and the judge at the hearing asked me and gave me the opportunity to file a motion for rebuttal, to present rebuttal evidence, which I availed myself of the opportunity. As far as what's the real issue here, and this court, in asking one question earlier, was this modification really a request for an advisory opinion? Was there anything at all to be gained by what they did here? They essentially turned an irrebuttable presumption on its head, and I just don't feel that unless we get the opportunity, if this court should feel that it needs to overturn the board. I think in order, in the interest of justice, in the interest of finality, in the interest of accuracy, that we, May Sharp, should be given the opportunity to address the issue of whether or not Mr. Sharp's death was hastened by his black lung. I know that may sound a little unusual or a little odd in looking at a potential negative decision, but I would submit to you that, I hate to use cliches, but what is good for the goose should be good for the gander here. It's a situation where Mr. Mattingly raised in his brief, I believe in the reply brief, that they still could have pursued the $600 or so that, if they're successful, they would owe to the Department of Labor for the exam that Mr. Sharp had performed on him. Well, that would have been during his lifetime. So they were aware of that, yet did not avail themselves of the opportunity, as I said, during his lifetime, to clarify the issues that perhaps they felt were wrong. They sat on their rights. They waited until essentially the door was closed. And at that point, they filed a modification, which they have a right to do. But when is enough enough? When should things be final? Even this court talked about the judge addressing finality and asking Judge Kaplan to address finality. But when does that end? We've been going back and forth from a complicated co-worker's pneumoconiosis decision on the remand that Judge Johnson found to the board, Benefits Review Board, affirming that decision to Westmoreland resting on that decision and letting that decision become final, waiting that 6-year period of time, and then and only then, despite having plenty of time in that interim period while Mr. Sharp was alive, only then waiting and filing its modification. I suppose then what perhaps can or we should consider, and this may be a little bit silly, if I were permitted to withdraw the survivor's claim at this point, which I'm sure I wouldn't be, and refiled it, in other words, withdraw it without prejudice and refile it, based on the new regulations, I would be entitled to an award right off the bat, because there was a total disability finding, in fact, a complicated co-worker's pneumoconiosis finding, and because of those new regulations, we would, and Senator Byrd's legislation, we would essentially get an award without all of this. Now, granted, that's hypothetical. Thank you, Ron.
Thank you, Mr. Bednar. Mr. Mattingly, you have some time reserved.
Let me address the death certificate issue first. There was a death certificate that was issued as part of the director exhibits. It's at Director's Exhibit 67. Hearing happened in September. Because of scheduling problems with my calendar, Dr. Fino's calendar, Mr. Bednar's calendar, we found a date to take his deposition in October. Everybody agreed upon that. ALJ Kaplan said that's fine. After Dr. Fino's deposition, Mr. Bednar's, my recollection is in November, then submitted what he purported to be a revised death certificate that included CWP as an additional cause of death. The administrative law judge said, no, you've not established good cause for not getting this earlier. You've had the death certificate for a couple years. If you wanted to get that revised, you should have done it earlier. You should have let the parties know at the hearing this was what you're going to do. It was unfair to everyone. abuse of discretion, and the board affirmed what he did was not an abuse of discretion. And that was affirmed when this case came to this court previously. Ms. Rapolo did not address whether or not the department still believes accuracy trumps finality. I think it does. And I think that's what I learned from the Supreme Court decisions, and that's what you learn from what is in the interest of justice. Because as this court explained in the unpublished Henderson decision, the Benefits Review Board said nothing would go more against this act than having somebody get benefits who wasn't entitled to them, who wasn't totally disabled due to co-workers' pneumoconiosis. Employers, claimants, the Department of Labor have an odd relationship in black lung claims. It's a three-legged stool. You don't know who your opponent always is on this three-legged stool. If there's no estate, if Mrs. Sharp really can't stand in on behalf of her deceased husband to litigate that case, then the employer has paid the Department of Labor diagnostic cost to do the Department of Labor examination, as well as interest. And the part of the regulations that deal with the trust fund do allow for the department to pay back those costs that are either incorrectly assessed against employers or are part of the administration. In fact, if the award is set aside, Westmoreland can ask the Department of Labor to reimburse back to them those diagnostic costs of $602, which gives us a case in controversy to get over that concern.
Now, they don't agree with that. They say that was all settled back in the early 90s.
And it was. It was paid. There's no doubt.
Right.
But I think that, as attached to their brief, that portion of the statute that deals with the trust fund clearly shows administrative cost and also reimbursement, when appropriate, can be made from the trust fund, and reimbursement would be appropriate because if the award's overturned, then it's inappropriate to assess those diagnostic costs against the employer. The director suggests, well, that's a benefit that should be recollected from the estate. That makes no sense to me whatsoever. Claimants never pay for the Department of Labor evaluation. It's a statutorily provided right to claimants, win, lose, or not. It's only assessed against employers when benefits are awarded. If the benefits are ultimately set aside in the miner's claim, which is what we've asked in the modification, those costs would have to be reimbursed by the Department of Labor to the employer. The suggestion that Westmoreland just kind of sat around for 7 years and did nothing and let evidence go stale doesn't make sense. Westmoreland paid benefits for 7 years, as ALJ Kaplan found. Westmoreland did not, and this record has nothing in here to suggest that Westmoreland was privy to any of these medical treatment records, that any medical costs were submitted under the Black Lung Act for Westmoreland to pay. And more importantly, there's no discovery mechanism or right for an employer to go back to an awarded claimant and say, hey, I want another pulmonary evaluation. Give me all your treatment records during the time I'm paying the case. The case is over at that point. You can't continue on discovery as if it's an ongoing case.
You could have gotten an autopsy, couldn't you?
Only if one's performed. One had been performed, yes.
Say that again. I couldn't hear you. Say that again.
If an autopsy had been performed, yes. That would have been the ultimate.
You could have gotten one performed.
She could have. But that's up to her. That's not, the employer has no basis, and I don't think Congress would want to have mandatory autopsies in black lung cases. That doesn't make sense. The Department of Labor's presentation this morning essentially re-argued the facts they would like the fact finder to decide in a way contrary to the way L.J. Kaplan did. That's not what this court's supposed to do. She's inviting you to reweigh the facts, just like the Benefits Review Board did. This is an abuse of discretion review. Is what ALJ Kaplan did so wrong it cannot stand? And I suggest it's not. He had good cause to find that the employer's motive to overturn that prior incorrect award based on an erroneous finding of complicated pneumoconiosis merited modification of the miner's claim and then allowed him to reconsider the merits of the survivor's claim, inasmuch as there was no automatic presumption that death was due to pneumoconiosis. No one's asking for an advisory opinion. I think there's a real case in controversy here. Unlike Article III cases that come up, case in controversy really is different in the administrative world. And the modification regulation may be one of those classic examples, because what it says is any time within 1 year of the last payment of benefits, you can ask for a do-over. And the Supreme Court's told us that's exactly what it says. A party can simply say, I think you got it wrong. Take another look at it, with or without new evidence. That's what Westmoreland did.
The best argument that this is not futile is that the $600-some?
I think that proves that there's a case or controversy, yes. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mattingly. All right, we'll come down and greet counsel and then take a brief recess.